good morning and welcome to Jump in Tucson, the Monday edition. This is where we talk about the great things going on at the University of Arizona, including, of course, student learning, student projects, student outcomes, but also the top-level performances by artists and athletes, and especially top-tier research going on with faculty and scientists at the University of Arizona. With us this morning is a friend of mine, which we came to know each other for the wrong reasons, but she's wonderful. I've known her for quite a while. Her name is Dr. Clara Curiel Lewandowski. I know her as Dr. Curiel. Welcome to Jump in Tucson.
Good morning, Ed.
When I look at your list of all the things that you're involved in at the Cancer Center and at the College of Medicine Dermatology and the Dermatology Department of Medicine and the residency program and the endowed chair for cancer research and the division of dermatology at Banner, holy smokes, it's a long list. But I'm just going to embarrass you right now and say you are probably one of the most renowned doctors knowing about skin cancer of anyone in the world. Am I right in saying that?
Well, it's a whole team working on this.
But it is you, and you're amazing. And I often tell people, you know, I'm susceptible to skin cancer and have been a patient of yours and of the Dermatology Center at Banner for many, many years. And I tell people I have the most famous person in the world working on me from time to time, and I think that's great that we have you here in Tucson. So let's talk a little bit. You're from South America, so tell a little bit about your journey of how you got to Tucson and how you ended up being at Banner and where you are now.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me today. Mm. It's always a pleasure to see you and also talk to the community, which is always an interest of ours, right? I came from Venezuela. It has been an interesting journey, a good journey. Mm-hmm. I completed my medical school there, and then I left many years ago because I have always been interested in science, and I was seeking new opportunities to expand in that area. That's when I left many years ago, working research in Boston, then in Germany, mm-hmm. went back to Boston for my residency training, fellowship training. I was working as a faculty member in the Boston area for many years before I was recruited to come to Arizona. And because of my interest in skin cancer, it was a tremendous opportunity 20 years ago to come and start this journey here, which is applying the science, the know-how, in an area of incredible need,
right,
which was Arizona. When I came 20 years ago and I interviewed for the job and I asked, where's your skin cancer program? Where are the multidisciplinary component? Where are all the research, where's all the research infrastructure? And they say, we're hoping for you to come here and put it together. And it has been fantastic because there was a need, mm-hmm. and with a great team that we have been able to build together now to address this challenge.
I don't know if I met you that first year, but I you know, your old office, I was one of the first patients, and I give your staff and team and everybody at the Banner Dermatology now a terrible time, and they just, like, I tried to make them laugh when I come in there. And the program has grown. It's amazing how much is going on there. So let's just talk, your specialty is skin cancer. What is skin cancer?
Skin cancer, we know what cancer is, which mm-hmm. is basically the proliferation of atypical cells, and they, depending on the organ that is involved, then is lung cancer, breast cancer, skin cancer. So when it comes to skin cancer, there are two main type of cells that drive into cancer. One is called the keratinocytes, which are superficial type of skin cells, and you have other type of cells at the basal layer called melanocytes. The melanocytes are the ones who are responsible to produce the pigment in your skin and protect you from UV rays. So either one of these cells can evolve into cancer. So those that proliferate from keratinocytes become the non-melanoma skin cancer, and those that proliferate from the melanocyte are known as melanoma. And we have those, that's how we classify skin cancer, non-melanoma and melanoma skin cancers. Just to give you a sense of how relevant skin cancer is for both of these subtypes, we have about 5.1 million skin cancer diagnosed every year in the United States. And this data is old, and we'll tell you why is it old. We have, this probably was published in 2011. And the problem that we have, at least in the United States, is that we don't have a mandate to report all skin cancers. Mm-hmm. We only report melanomas.
Right.
The non-melanoma skin cancer are so many of them, by the vast majority of cancers, our skin cancers, we don't have the capacity to keep track. And this is why we only really pay attention to melanoma when it comes to number. But the burden of disease for non-melanoma skin cancer is huge. It's one in every five American that will have skin cancer.
That's amazing. So why are, urban myth as it might be, maybe I made this up, I don't know. But I say that, I teach my students at the U of A when I'm talking about that they should wear sunscreen and the hat and so forth. I say that Tucson is one of the highest incidents of skin cancer in the world. And I don't know if that's accurate, but it is true. But why are Southern Arizona susceptible to skin cancer? What is the reason for it?
Well, there is a couple of factors that drive that high incidence rate of skin cancer. One is the number of days that we have with UV ray, a high index exposure. We have about 300 days of sunny days during the year.
And clear skies,
and
right?
Clear skies. Yeah. So definitely when you look at UV index now on your phone, that you can look at it all the time whenever you want to, it is quite striking. In fact, within the United States, we are number one in Arizona when it comes to UV index, between Yuma, Phoenix, and then Tucson being those at risk. The second reason is because we have a large retirement population in Arizona. And as we know, the rate for skin cancer starts going up after the age of 45 and 50, depending on the history of sun exposure you might have had. So that combination sets Arizona very much as a state with high incidence skin cancer.
Right. My son, who's 33 now and just got married, did a report one time, I think, and used you as the backdrop for that, and did an interview with you. And the analogy he used was that your skin is like a bucket, and the water that you go put in a bucket is the sun. And once that bucket starts to overflow, that's skin cancer. I mean, that was kind of the your skin can only take so much sun over the course of a lifetime. Yeah,
that's right. And the earlier exposure is even more important, because when your skin is exposed to UV rays, you induce mutations in your skin cells, and those mutations accumulate over time. And your capacity to get rid of those mutations in your cells decrease as you age.
Right.
So between the mutations accumulating as you get older and your capacity to get rid of them decreases, then definitely after the age of 50, that's when we see people increasing the rate of skin cancer.
I'm kind of a religious guy. I go to church every weekend, and I thank God for golf and for butterflies and for rainbows and for good food and for nitrogen, because I go into your offices on a regular basis and they nail me with the nitrogen. When we come back after the break, we're going to talk a little bit about what you do at Banner and that whole process of taking care of people. And we're speaking with Dr. Clara Curiel. We'll be back after the break to talk about Banner Dermatology and what she does at the University of Arizona. You're listening to Jump in Tucson on KVOI. Welcome back to Jump in Tucson. This is Ed Ackerley, and this is the Monday Wonder Series, where we talk about the good things and good people going on at the U of A, the research and the outcomes. And one of those world-famous people, I call her, if she's not the most important person in skin cancer research in the world, she's my most important person, because she takes care of me. This is Dr. Clara Curiel. So welcome back.
Thank you.
So skin cancer, it's an important thing for people who live in Southern Arizona to be aware of and to take care of. And it's one of the most curable forms of cancer, right? If we do maintenance and take care of it, then we can live a long, healthy life and just manage the damage. But if you get melanoma and you don't take care of it, then it could be some deadly outcomes, right?
Absolutely. So when you think of skin cancer, there are three opportunities to intervene. The first one is to prevent it, right? So we're smarter now. We know how to live in harmony with the sun, how we like to call it. And learning that early on is going to serve you well over your years. The second opportunity to intervene is early detection. So you were not able to prevent it or didn't enough to prevent it, then how can we find it early? And this is where it becomes key to educate the community on what are the warning signs, how skin cancer might look like, how to seek attention. Mm-hmm. And in addition to individuals identifying their own skin cancer, and I always tell this to my patients, and they know this, they have an incredible power to find their skin cancer if they know what they're looking for and they have a level of awareness. And the earlier you can find your skin cancer, the better likelihood you're going to have to either cure it with a small procedure or even applying a cream, rather than going the route of large surgeries, immunotherapies, chemotherapy. So you're your best advocate in this, and I always tell that everyone. The second opportunity for early detection is your provider, who is your primary care, your dermatologist, and the tools that they have to find your skin cancer early. And that is interesting, you know, across the board, there is something called number needed to biopsy. So how many biopsies will each provider need to do to find your skin cancer? And there are some interesting papers out there that we have worked on in addition with the Australian experience, is that the more trained your provider is to look for skin cancer and detect it, the fewer biopsies you're going to need to have. Right. So also looking at expertise, make sure you seek attention is very important.
So you kind of have a dual role. You are doing research and, you know, and working with skin cancer researchers all around the world, and doing the academic slash scientific slash research side of things. But then you will also have a working lab where you have some residents and so forth. And those are the guys that I see that go out to your place, and they're looking at me on every 6 months, I guess, I go, or every 4 months, whatever it is. And so you're actually applying what you've been researching and learning over all these years to actual patients and teaching other doctors how to detect these skin cancers, right?
That is correct. And this is why academic medicine is the best medicine. Mm-hmm. We believe in it. It's because it has three pillars, right? It's research, education, and clinical care. Mm-hmm. So when you combine those three components, it's the best recipe ever to have any advance in the field and for patient care, because it's a continuous feedback loop between interesting questions, not only interesting, but very much gaps in the field that we need to address, and then being able to go to the bench, identify solutions, and then educate the next generation on how to apply these findings.
Right. So Bill and I and our family grew up here in Tucson, and, you know, we can remember going to the pool, and some of the gals would put baby oil on their skin and lay out in the sun and turn, you know, olive skinned and tanned and so forth, and being tanned. And we would run around in the summertime with our shirts off and so forth. And I'm paying the price for it now because, you know, 50 years later, I come in and thank God for nitrogen, as I said. But what are things a person can do daily to avoid getting skin cancer? So you talk about the preventative actions a person can take. One is just to be aware of something. I get that. But what are some practical things that a person could do?
Yeah, the practical aspect is to, first of all, understand your routine, because we're not asking people to stop doing what they love doing, right? So that's why we come to Arizona. We love our sunny days. But going back to this phrase of living in harmony with the sun is exactly learning how to apply that to your daily life. If learning the time of the day where you're going to be outdoors before 10 a.m. in the morning or after 4 o'clock in the afternoon to do your outdoor activities, if you're going to be out, we always recommend, of course, sunscreen or sunblocks, but now the fashion with sun protected clothing is out there. Now it's more accepted, and people think it's actually something cool to do.
Right.
Before that, it wasn't the case. And we have better level of awareness on how to engage with the sun out there.
Right. I know I personally, for golf and for swimming, I have long sleeve shirts that are UV protected, and I even wear some, when I'm playing golf, I wear long pants that are UV protected.
And Arizona should lead this effort in the country. Mm-hmm. We should all be out there with our long sleeve your hat, and knowing when you come to Arizona, even people visiting Arizona, we can model the rest of the country on how we're supposed to interface with this challenge. That's where the Skin Cancer Institute at the University of Arizona is a premier leader when it comes to awareness. In fact, it's going to be recognized in 2 weeks in D.C. at the National Library.
Great.
With a congressman family as a lead organization in the country,
right,
being able to, you know, enforce this learning experience for everyone.
Congratulations. Do you get to go? Congratulations.
Yeah, we'll be there.
Yeah, that's fantastic. We're talking with Dr. Clara Curiel, who is an expert in skin cancer and skin cancer prevention and academics and research, and as well as preventative tools. So you talked about that very first thing that a person can do is be aware and to know their skin and know if something doesn't necessarily look right or whatever, to do something about it and not to just let it persist. So when should they come for a checkup? When should they, if they have not scheduled a dermatology appointment in a long time, maybe they should, and just to come in and see you, right?
That's a great question, and there's no straight answer either, but I think there are some general terms and criteria that we can use. If you're someone who had a lot of sun exposure, and you have multiple lesions in your skin, something you can feel, something you can see, getting a baseline assessment just to understand where your risk is at and run it by an expert, they will tell you you're at low, medium, high risk. And therefore, they're going to set up your follow-up routine based on that risk stratification. The other aspect of this is also if you're already, you know, seeing a dermatologist or a primary care, and you also have to pay attention to what's happening to your skin. And we always say anything that is new in your skin that doesn't look like anything else you have, something that you have on your skin but is changing at a different rate than any of your other lesions, growing, changing in size, or changes in color, mm-hmm. or it's starting to bleed, or itches for no reason, then that's something you want to bring it up. You can bring that up to your primary care, you can bring it up to your dermatologist, but seek care. Don't sit on it. And this is why we sometimes find that patients come to the clinic and say, I wish I could have come earlier. And say, yes, you could come earlier, but it's hard sometimes to get an appointment. Seeing a right. dermatologist sometimes, that is a waiting period.
Yeah, they're scheduling in April now. I was at the counter the other day at your place, and a lady was standing there, and they were trying to get an appointment. April, we're booked out to April, and that's because so many people are needing the care.
Yeah. And that is what is a bit challenging. And my recommendation to people out there who are worried about a skin lesion is call the office and say, I'm worried that I have a skin cancer.
Right.
That is so important because they don't know what your concern is. But when you say the word skin cancer, I can guarantee you any office is going to make an effort to try to get you in.
Right. So we're obviously Banner Dermatology and the research center that you have are great places, and obviously a primary care can help you. But just if someone wanted to learn something about, a little bit more about skin cancer and what I can do, what are some resources that you might recommend that they look at? Obviously look at what you guys are doing, but...
Absolutely. You know, looking at different practices, see what mm-hmm. is the best fit for you. Something that we, in a way, that we're unique at the Banner University Medical Group at BOMG is that we're multidisciplinary. So when you come to our practice, we're just not dermatologists mm-hmm. working there. It's a comprehensive team. It's called the Cutaneous Oncology Program. So mm-hmm. we have several dermatologists well-trained in skin cancer recognition and management. But you also have your surgical oncologist, you have your head and neck surgeon, you have your medical oncologist, you have your radiation oncologist, the pathologist, and we all work as a one team. Mm-hmm. And that's where it's so important for patients with intermediate risk and high risk that do not feel that their care is fragmented. Oh, right. I need to call this person here, I need to call this person there. But we're all glued together in a comprehensive program with a coordinator to facilitate the communication.
Right. So what's the future for Dr. Clara Curiel as you spent 20 years now doing this? What's the future look like for you at the university, and what are your plans?
Well, there are several plans, and that's where the excitement comes mm-hmm. in. One plan is on the research front. I think we're doing incredible work in drug development to identify new drugs that can modulate your immune system mm-hmm. and be applied as a cream and prevent your skin cancer from developing.
Great.
And this is one route that we're already have been working for many years, but we are very close to start launching these clinical trials very soon. And right. I think we'll be first-in-class drugs. And it's a great solution to a big problem. The second component is the early detection. We have a College of Optical Sciences at the university, mm-hmm. which is a premier site for optics. As we all know, we have probably four different technologies in development to early detect skin cancer without the need to do skin biopsies. Right. And we are excited about it. The next component is to look at partnering across different universities in the state, and this mm-hmm. will need some help, and it's going to take time.
Right.
But I think there is a tremendous power between all of the institutions across the state to come together and as a team solve this problem and be an example and a role model for the rest of the country how you take care of your own problems in your own house.
We really appreciate what you do. I appreciate what you do for me, and your staff does for me, and I have the scars to prove it, and I want to thank you for that. I think about you almost every day because I look at my marks that you guys have made on me, but I'm still alive here, and this is great. We've been talking with Dr. Clara Curiel. She is an expert in skin cancer mitigation and research and academics and at Banner, and we thank you for coming in this morning and joining us on Jump in Tucson.
Thank you. It has been a pleasure.
Great. Thank you. Welcome back to Jump in Tucson. This is Dr. Ed Ackerley. This is the Wonder Monday version of Jump in Tucson, where we talk about good things going on at the University of Arizona. And one of the things, if anybody's lived in Tucson for any length of time, knows the two words Valley Fever. And with us to talk about that is Dr. John Galgiani, who is a doctor who specializes in infectious diseases, but specifically in Valley Fever. So good morning, Doctor.
Good morning.
Thanks
nice
for
to be
being
here.
Thanks for being here. So to get started, let's just talk a little bit about you, and you have a career that you've been doing this a little while, and your experience and how you got to the University of Arizona.
Well, they offered me a job.
That's a good point.
That was the way it happened, actually. I was a fellow at Stanford doing infectious disease, and the person I was working with, David Stevens, his lab was working on fungi in general, and so I worked on fungi in general. But when I was offered a job in the University of Arizona back in 1978 and took it, the obvious fungus to think about much more focused way was coccidioides, which is hard to say, so people don't say it. They call it cocci or valley fever.
Right.
And that was, as I say, a while back, and I went on sabbatical and had time to think, and I realized I was enjoying being interested in this disease, two-thirds of which is actually in Arizona. So two-thirds of all U.S. infections occur in our state.
Wow.
And so I realized that maybe the University of Arizona should, as a land-grant institution, should take a certain responsibility to manage this disease. So when I came back, I suggested that to the Arizona Board of Regents, which is the way centers got developed, and they bought it and agreed to do that in 1996. So we've had a 30-year run since then.
It's called the Valley Fever Center for Excellence, right?
That's correct.
And so what goes on there? What obviously research, but what is happening, taking place in the Valley Fever Center for Excellence?
So the center, as the name implies, is focused on this one disease. And I've already mentioned why that makes a lot of sense, actually more so in Arizona or at the University of Arizona than anywhere else in the country. And so we are very interested in basic mechanisms of how this infection occurs, and just as much how it is that most people develop resistance to it and control it. Mm-hmm. And that leads to the idea of a vaccine, which we'll probably talk about a little bit later. But understanding the basic pathophysiology or the mechanisms of how this goes about has spinoff for all sorts of applications to actually make patients better. And so we're very interested in that. But also now with the affiliation of the clinical practice at the University of Arizona with Banner Health, that gives me an opportunity and others at the center to actually take our expertise with this disease and apply it to patients directly in the clinic. And I'm doing that as well.
Right. I don't know if it's an urban myth or something that I've just grown up with, but at one point in my life, and maybe right now, I believe that most people who have lived in Tucson that for any length of time maybe have already contracted Valley Fever and didn't even know they had it, and it came and went, and they're no worse the wear, but then other people got it, and it was worse. So first off, what is Valley Fever? What is this fungus doing, and what is happening, and how do you catch Valley Fever?
Well, Valley Fever is endemic. It only exists in certain parts of the Western Hemisphere. We live in one of those places. The valley is named after the San Joaquin or the Central Valley of California, not the Valley of the Sun in Phoenix, but actually with the explosion of population in Arizona since the 1950s, there are more cases now here than anywhere else in the country. Between California and Arizona, it's probably 95% of all diagnosed infections. And it's a fungus that lives in the dirt. Mm-hmm. It's a complicated ecology. It may involve rodents as well as the dirt itself. And why it lives there and not other places is not completely understood. It has something to do with dry climate. It has something to do with not terribly cold winters. As I say, rodents may be a factor too. But It grows in the dirt, and when it rains, the fungus probably undergoes a bloom. It grows more. And then when things dry out, spores from this fungus get in the air. And it's about a 3% chance per year, one chance in 30, that you actually inhale a spore. So the state data is that half of the people get their infection before 12 years of living here, and half of the people get it after 12 years. So it's not like overnight. Mm-hmm. But you're right. The longer you live here, the more likely you've had an infection. And you may not have known it. Two out of three people who get infected really don't have an illness that they seek medical attention for. Mm-hmm. They may have some illness, but it's minor, not enough to figure out how to see a doctor. But the one out of three that do get sick get pretty sick. They have an illness that lasts weeks to months, and it can be very impacting. Fatigue is often a very big symptom in that, but also chest pain, aches and pains. One of the synonyms for valley fever is desert rheumatism, because joint complaints are so common with this. And that lasts, as I say, for a long period of time, seeking medical attention. And if you don't get the diagnosis correct, doctors often do lots of things for you, which you may or may not get any benefit from whatsoever. For instance, if you develop a syndrome of pneumonia, which is one of the very common ways patients with valley fever appear, they'll start an antibacterial treatment, an antibiotic. And then if you don't get better, they'll start another one, and maybe even a third, even though you actually have a fungal infection. If you knew that, all that stuff is unnecessary.
That wouldn't be helpful in that case.
So early diagnosis turns out to be extremely useful, even as it turns out for most people who get this infection, they end up not getting progressive. It goes away eventually because the immune system controls it, mm-hmm. even though it takes a long time. Everyone gets over it, except for a small percentage of people. And in those people, it actually becomes extremely serious. It goes through the bloodstream to other parts of the body. And now I'm talking one out of 200 people who get infected. So it's a small percentage. But those people get meningitis. They can have bone infections. They can have big abscesses. And that's not trivial. And they those patients really need a lot of medical care.
So why, kind of when we went through the COVID-19 era, obviously, everyone was afraid of getting infected. And some people got infected, some people lost their lives, and some people reacted severely to it and were down for quite a while. And other people just kind of seem to maybe get it and have a sniffle and a cough, and they're kind of gone. Why is it different in different people? Why does valley fever affect, if you get the spores and why do some people are affected differently than other people? Is that...
So that's a really good question. It's probably... not because of the number of spores you inhale. We think most people probably get only one or two spores to cause an infection. It's very easy to start an infection with this fungus. It's also probably not because different fungi are different in their ability to cause disease. Almost all the data at the moment says it has to do with differences in people's immune system. Mm-hmm. And it's not exactly that they have mutations. And we don't see families with the bad stuff. We see individual people sporadically in families. Mm-hmm. And it's probably, the term is complex immunogenetics. Now, I think of genetics as being complicated right off the bat, but complex immunogenetics is when more than one gene is involved. And it's the participation of two or more genes which have little differences in each one of them. And the combination of these little differences not quite controlling the fungus correctly, we think is the main reason that some people get sick and some people don't.
That's very interesting. So there's no real crystal ball that says this group of people is going to get it and this group of people is going to get it worse. And you can't really predict that per se.
We can't today.
Yeah, but what the hope is, right?
If we understood, and this is getting back to this idea of understanding the fundamental mechanisms, if we understood those pathways where those different genes are involved, that could lead to a test which you could have before you got sick, before you inhaled a fungus spore. And then we could tell you, you're going to be fine. You're not going to have any illness, or other people might, you look like you're going to get a bone infection.
Right.
That would really be nice.
Well, when we come back after the break, we'll delve a little bit more into some of the things and the cutting edge science that's going in. We're talking with Dr. John Gagliani from the University of Arizona, talking about that that thing that gives the gift that keeps on giving in Southern Arizona, Valley Fever. And when we come back after the break, we'll talk some more about that. You're listening to KVOI 1030 AM, The Voice, and you're listening to Jump in Tucson. We'll be back after the break. Welcome back to Jump in Tucson. This is Dr. Ed Ackerley, and this is the Monday version where we talk about wonder, the good things going on at the University of Arizona, specifically in science and academic research and all the things that go into that. We're talking this morning with Dr. John Galgiani, and tell us a little bit about that last name. Where does that it's a little bit of Italiano in it, but it's you were telling
me. it's actually Swiss.
Swiss.
It's up the hill from Lake Lugano in Switzerland, southern Switzerland, and there's a little town, Caviano, which is where my ancestors came from.
That's fantastic. So I'm trying to get the pronunciation of that down just muy perfecto, okay. Well, we were talking about Valley Fever and how this comes. Let's talk, before we talk about the early detection and the recognition and all that, let's talk about dogs and why are canines, why is this important to the discussion of Valley Fever?
Well, it turns out if you talk to veterinarians in Tucson or elsewhere around the Sonoran Desert, they'll tell you how bad the problem is of Valley Fever in dogs. They test for Valley Fever very commonly. If they don't quite understand what's going on with the patient, with their pet dog, they'll test them for Valley Fever, because the dogs that get this disease, and they get it maybe four times as frequently as humans, actually. And when they get it, it's really they're all not subtle. They have limps, or they have cough, or they're losing weight. It's usually a very serious disease. They typically are treated routinely. Patients with a new diagnosis mm-hmm. get treated, and that treatment can often last for many months to many years, and the treatments are expensive, and unfortunately, some people don't have the money to do that, and those dogs sometimes have to be put to sleep because mm-hmm. the owner can't pay for it.
Or suffer a long time with the Valley Fever while they're, because they don't have the money to pay for the
treatment.
That's right. Yeah. So what is it, because dogs tend to be more earthy, you know, digging around in the dirt and stirring up the pores or the spores, or is it something else that is there research on why dogs would be susceptible to the Valley Fever?
Yeah, we don't really know, a lot of people think they're close to the ground, they're sniffing a mm-hmm. lot. That's very possibly why they get infected more often.
And so some of the research that's been done is kind of connected to that, connected to how dogs get Valley Fever and what their response to it is. So okay, let's talk a little bit about that early detection recognition, and again with doctors that are trained on the East Coast or some other country or something, and they're not really familiar with the Valley Fever syndromes. What would you what is on the horizon with Banner and your research and so forth that might give us some hope for the future?
Well, as I said, we're now up close with Banner in taking care of patients, and that's allowed me to develop some quality improvement for Banner, especially in the outpatient setting. Mm-hmm. And we've been working with Banner Urgent Care, which has some 55 clinics around Maricopa and Phoenix and Tucson, mm-hmm. and they were really, like many places across the state, were not testing patients when they should be. Mm-hmm. Back in 2020. And we've instituted some reminders, and now we have a dashboard to give them really real-time feedback as to what's going on in the community. And now the testing rate of people who present with pneumonia in Banner Urgent Care is up to 50% from 2%. Mm-hmm. And I think we can probably get that even higher as we go. I'm going to try to do this with the emergency rooms as well. And doing that just allows for all sorts of unnecessary healthcare to stop being done, because right. if you don't have the right diagnosis, doctors trying to make you better will do what they think might be the right thing. But if they don't know what it is, it's wrong.
If they think it's a virus, they're going to treat it like they would treat a virus,
right.
and it's a fungus, and it's not treated the same way.
Right. Or if they think it's a bacterial infection, they start an antibiotic, mm-hmm. and that's just not helpful if you have a fungal infection. So,
right.
so all of that stuff can be done better.
And this is all based in the lungs, basically, right? But starts in the lungs?
It starts in the lungs, and many times the symptoms are related to a chest cold, chest pain, cough, those kinds of symptoms. But then after a while, the symptoms can be very systemic. And as I said, fatigue, some people, the last thing to go away months after the infection is otherwise gone is a fatigue that keeps people from just doing what they want, maybe not even able to go to work. So it's very much like long COVID.
Right.
Maybe some of the mechanisms are the same.
There's some hope here that in early recognition and so forth, and some treatments of this, and doctors recognizing these symptoms. But there's one more thing to worry about, and and that is that will the effects of climate change, as we heat up the Southwest a little bit more, and the air is a little bit drier, and the dirt is drier, and then all of a sudden the spores sprout again, and they're up again. This could be a problem, right, in the future.
It could be.
Yeah.
In fact, there's modeling for climate change that predicts that with changes in heat and rainfall, that the endemic region, which is now localized to certain parts of the Southwest primarily, could be all the way up to the Canadian border by the end of this century. Mm-hmm. And we'll see if that happens, but it just could be not just the localized disease that it is currently.
Right. Over in the Middle East right now, and even in Africa, they're giving doses for polio vaccines right now because we thought we had it eradicated, and it's coming back in a few places. Will we ever be done with Valley Fever? Is there a point in the future that we might be able to say we figured it out and we can mitigate against it?
Well, because so many people, almost everybody who gets Valley Fever gets over it because of their immune system, that mm-hmm. really begs the question, why can't we just do that with a vaccine? And that idea's been in play since the 1950s. Mm-hmm. And very recently, over the last several years, at the University of Arizona, a couple of the faculty at the Valley Fever Center have discovered a vaccine, not because they were searching for a vaccine, but because they were interested in basic mechanisms of how this fungus causes disease. But with that new information, out popped a vaccine, which is now actually in development as a vaccine to prevent Valley Fever in dogs. And there's a very real possibility it will be available to veterinarians in a year from now. And I'm a physician, so I'm very interested in that vaccine, not just as good as it would be to prevent Valley Fever in dogs, to also keep this momentum going and take this into clinical trials for humans as well.
And there's been a grant that's been given for that, and the companies are working on that vaccine. And
that's right. We originally got a research grant from the NIH. This was 6 years ago, and we joined with a commercial partner, Anavive Life Sciences, a startup company in California, and they're the ones that are developing this vaccine for dogs. And now, just this summer, Anavive got a contract from the National Institutes of Health, could be as much as $33 million, which would take this vaccine into first-in-human trials.
That's great. That's great. Where could people go to get some more information on what you guys do down at the center or Valley Fever in general? What do you recommend that if they want to learn a little bit more about, maybe I have Valley Fever, what do I do? Obviously, talk to your physician, but...
We, as it turns out, have a website.
Okay.
And it's VFCE, standing for Valley Fever Center for Excellence, .Arizona, spelled out, .edu.
Great.
Actually, if you type in VFCE, you'll probably get Valley Fever Center for Excellence. And that website has lots of information, not just for clinicians and researchers, but also for the general public.
Thank you, Dr. John Gagliani, and thank you for the work you've doing on Valley Fever, and we appreciate you being in. And we'll have you and Dr. Curiel back and talk about the pillars of the Banner experience.
That'd be wonderful. Thank you.
Great. If you'd like to be interviewed on Jump in Tucson and share your success story, go to jumpintucson.com and let us know a little about you. And who knows, maybe you'll be live on the air on a Monday Wonder Series or one of the other days. Jump in Tucson broadcast from the Bustos Media Studios and KVOI 1030 AM Radio. Thank you for listening, and we hope that you will jump in Tucson.